Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, and today my guest is Lawrence Brownlee. Lawrence is an award-winning opera singer who has performed in some of the world's most prestigious opera houses. He's originally from Youngstown, Ohio, and grew up playing music in church, but not singing. And he definitely had very little exposure to classical music. After a high school teacher recognized his unique talent, he started down the path of study and performance that led to a career as an operatic tenor. We talked about some of his recent projects like Rising, a work that sets the poetry of the Harlem Renaissance to music, but we started out our conversation by discussing the very practical matter of how singers protect their voice.
To start, I don't smoke and I don't drink. I don't do drugs. So already that's probably going to keep me in a good place. But I try to get as much rest as I can. You know, I try not to misuse my voice. I don't try to do anything that will be harmful. I don't scream. I try to speak in a way that's supported, you know, not walking around sounding like an opera singer when I speak, but just something that's healthy. Just something that I feel like, special care, but nothing too over the top. And, you know, everybody understands what works for them, for their body, for their voice, to make sure that they can be in hopefully optimal shape. And with that being said, we always deal with things like reflux and allergies and COVID and colds and all these other things too. So you have to try to navigate those things with understanding your voice and using good technique. Just trying to be smart and not make stupid decisions is the thing that I do to try to stay in as best shape as I can.
Excellent. What I love about what I know about your work is how you kind of weave a wide range of songs into your performances, be it kind of Mozart or spirituals. And that leads me to ask a lot of questions. So the first one is, you know, did you grow up singing in the church? Which I know, you know, so many Black singers get their start in some kind of spiritual format or some format that is, if not church, or at least kind of singing along the hymns and whatnot. But is that kind of where you first found your voice?
Yeah, I am a kid of the church. I grew up in a church called the Church of God in Christ. My father was the church choir director. My mother was the featured soloist, one of them at least. And so I'm one of six kids, and music was just a big part of my, you know, my growing up, my background. And so, yeah, I did. I actually started playing instruments because I was pretty shy about singing. I didn't want to sing at all, but people, you know, pushed me and encouraged me. And, you know, sometimes it's the thing that you do that sets yourself apart. So that's what began to happen, that people started to notice me for my voice because my father told me that I had to sing, even though I didn't want to. My background and all of my training, everything that I know, really started in the church. And that was the beginning, I guess, of my formal education with music.
What instruments did you first take up? Were you like a trumpet horn player?
I did play the trumpet. To be honest, though, the first instrument that I was drawn to was the drums. I grew up in a pretty active Pentecostal church, and the drums kept the rhythm, and they were loud, and they made a pleasant noise. And so as a kid, even as a little kid, my mom said I would get on the ground and be crawling up towards the drums because I wanted to be closer to the action. So that was the first thing that I fell in love with. My father always loved to play the electric guitar, so he kind of put that in my hands, and I think that that was the first formal lesson of anything that I took. And then when I got into elementary school, fourth and fifth grade, they had a band. And so I started then playing the trumpet. So I've had a lot of different instruments in my hands and things that I appreciate. The thing that I would say that has been the most that I've had the biggest love affair with is the bass guitar. And so in my church, there can only be one bass guitar player, and my cousin played that. So I couldn't jump on that. But later on, when I got into college, I gravitated towards that. They ended up playing on a pretty decent level. I used to play professionally or semi-professional bass guitar. But yeah, there's a lot of things that kind of informed who I am as a musician before the singing part.
Do you have do you still play the bass? And do you have any bass players you love or bass influences that you loved growing up?
Oh, my gosh. So many, of course. If you're a bass player, there's a lot of guys that you got to tip your hat to. Of course, Larry Graham. Of course, Jaco Pastorius is a great one. Victor Wooten is another guy. Marcus Miller. There's so many. A lot of these young guys today, oh, my gosh, some of these guys are good. And I always say, if I had grown up in the era of YouTube, I would be a much better bass player. But so many of these guys. The king, Jamerson. I mean, this guy James was Jamerson, like, yes, James Jamerson was the king. And so, you know, I grew up playing gospel bass, and a lot of these guys, Fred Hammond, when he played with Commission back in the day, big fan of his. But so many of these guys now today that they make the bass do things you just think, oh my gosh, was it even invented for that? But I'm a bass junkie, and I play a little bit. My fingers don't quite work the way they used to, but every now and again I do pick it up. And me and my buddy, we do these concerts, and we did like opera goes to gospel. And so part of that was me singing in the first half and me playing the bass guitar in the second half. So I will pick it up, but it's not the same as it used to be.
Incredible. So how did you, or how did classical music find you? What was that journey like from the instrumentation and from kind of singing in the church to getting that first kind of, scratching the first itch of classical music?
Right. It was my high school choral teacher. And because I had three sisters that were older than me, the first day I got to school as a freshman, he came up to me and said, "You're going to be in my choir." My sisters, they all sang. And so I guess he felt that there was a musical tradition there. And when I was in the choir, I remember the thing that first stood me apart is there was every year we had a big concert, every semester, I guess you call it. And there was a big concert. And so there was a strong choir tradition at this school, my school, Youngstown, East Ohio. And he would put up a sign for all the people to audition for the big solo. And I was a freshman. So you had all the stars of the choir, the seniors, the juniors who knew, everybody knew that these were pretty decent soloists. And so they were pretty proud of themselves as well. But I remember that he did a round of auditions and wasn't happy. And he said, "I want you to audition for the solo." So I auditioned for the solo and he gave me the solo. So that was the first time that I was kind of set apart amongst my peers in school for my singing. But it was him that said, "There's something about the quality of your voice that is special. You're a high tenor voice that lends itself to classical music. So you should pursue it." And I thought, no way, I don't like this stuff. I don't even really know what it is. I was not a soloist. I was very, very comfortable singing in a choir setting. But he said, "No, you must sing because you have something to say." So it was him that kind of found out what he said, that there was something in me that I needed to pursue. And that was the beginning of me pursuing anything in classical music.
So the thing that I was most excited to talk to you about is Rising, which I think that you are still kind of in the middle of touring right now. As a writer and as someone who, for those who don't know, Rising is, I guess I'll let you explain, but in short, it's a song cycle that sets texts by Black writers during the Harlem Renaissance to music. And that really excited me. And I know that that's, in kind of reading and researching, I know this is something you've been dreaming up and working on for a few years now. But what was the spark behind that? And what has the process been like of bringing this song cycle to life?
Well, for me, I think as an artist, someone who's getting the chance to sing on some of these important stages of the world, and also someone who does a great deal of art song recitals, it is important to try to add to the canon of what's being performed in these art song recitals. And myself, very proud African-American and, you know, a big fan of all of the great writers of the Harlem Renaissance. There are so many that I could name: W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Alain LaCroix, Claude McKay. There's so many. James Weldon Johnson that I admire. You know, I felt like I wanted to do something to bring even more illumination to their works. And so getting a chance to work with young composers, African-American composers who need to get their voices out, who need the opportunity to have someone to write for, I felt like it was a great thing to do.
How would you have us as we are? Or sinking neath the load we bear? Our eyes fixed forward on a star? Or gazing empty at despair?
This is, you know, it's been something that I've done before. There's another song cycle called Cycles of My Being that I was a part of commissioning. And so commissioning that and this and hopefully more things in the future, that's something I like to do. But I think it's important. And I think that because I'm singing it and taking this around, I hope other people, even people who are not African-American, will want to sing these songs and really appreciate this song cycle, because these writers contribute so much to the American story. And I think it's just the best way to proliferate or get their work out there even more.
As a Black singer in the space of classical music and performing classical music, how have you seen the world, the broader ecosystem of classical music, be it institutionally or through audiences? How have you seen that shift through your time performing? And where do you hope the evolution continues or goes?
There's been a shift. I think anybody, you know, who has a brain understands that probably in the last three years or so, there's been one of the largest shifts. Obviously, with you know, COVID, and during the time of COVID, we were all sitting at home and we witnessed George Floyd. And I think there's awareness and understanding that the inequities and, of course, the lack of opportunities has been highlighted because of that singular event that is just one of many. So I think that there's been a real shift, but also because not only myself, but other singers are getting to the chance to establish themselves as meaningful, important artists in this art form. I think people give a lot of respect to what people have done. And if we ourselves are very serious and committed to presenting the works of these wonderful composers and our story, I think it'll help with the shift. So I think people are eager to hear more things and eager to see more of us out there, you know, filling the stages of these important institutions, because they respect us as artists, because our reputations or our what we've done really is speaking for us. And so I think we are viewed as important artists today. And I think that that's important. And I hope we as artists really take the responsibility to say, okay, let's continue to do this and to further establish that we are meaningful people that have something to contribute to this, to what we do in classical music.
Absolutely. I personally like a singer who, I don't like using the word effortless, because I understand that this takes a lot of work, but there are singers who I think make singing feel as though it's like talking, or feel as though it's like an extension of a conversation, so to speak.
I appreciate you
your
saying
voice
that.
Has such, what's that?
No, I said, I appreciate you, Sam. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I just think your voice has this great flexibility to it. I don't know if that's the best word, but that's the word in lieu of a better word. There's this great flexibility to your voice that, you know, again, I think it does sound like there's effort being put out, but the effort does not show up at the expense of the actual work. Everything is really clear. Everything is really tone sharp. I'm just kind of, what was your education like? How do you get, for lack of a more technical question, how do you get your voice to consistently do that?
Well, again, as I said, I appreciate you saying that. My teacher, she said that our singing should be an extension of our speaking, and it should be as if we're not working. Of course, you are working, and what we do with our voices are we use our whole body. So we use everything from the heels and the toes of our feet all the way to the crown of our head. And so basically when we sing with our whole body, we use our bodies in the most efficient way. One of the things about me is I love sports. And so I'm a big fan of tennis and I play tennis. I even played yesterday with my wife, but we play tennis and it is really about using the whole body, whole arm, the shoulder, everything else to work together. And once you kind of cheat one part of it, it doesn't work well. The kinetic chain of things and the vent of things make you efficiently work as best as possible in the game of tennis. The same thing is true with singing. And so if I can sound like what I'm doing sounds easy, that means I'm using my whole instrument, which is not just my vocal cords, my tongue, my mouth, all these other things, but my entire body. That means I'm doing the thing that I can, you know, what I can, my discipline the most efficiently possible, and I'm not putting strain on any particular place of my body. And so I appreciate that, and that's what I think. I think about breathing. I think about the support. I think about lack of tension. I think about position. I think about the vowels. I think about all these things. I think about the position of the tongue. And so it has to be something that's ingrained. So every second of what you're doing is not, you're not constantly consciously thinking about it, but you can turn that off and really allow your body to work as one single instrument that produces the sound you want. So that's the way I approach it. And I appreciate you saying that, because that means that my teacher's technique is working.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you mentioned Cycles of My Being, and I wanted to track back to it because I'm such a big fan of Tyshawn Story and the poet Terrence Hayes, who's someone I learned from and still learn from. I've never met Tyshawn. I'm just kind of an admirer from afar. What was it like getting to work with him and kind of working with Terrence and kind of building out that body of work that I think was really just expansive and in a way really vulnerable in terms of, I think it was something I turned to when I think I was like looking for answers of or looking for ways to complicate the broader questions of love and optimism and anger and these things like that. So what was it like working with those folks?
You know, when I'm around both of those gentlemen, I'm definitely not the smartest guy in the room. Those guys are brilliant, both of them, Terrence and Tyshawn. And I remember when we all met, both of those gentlemen seemed like they were in search for the truth, for the answers, always interrogating what it is they do as artists. And so in working with Tyshawn, someone who is insanely talented, and his concept or understanding of music and rhythm and structure and contrast and dissonance and harmony and just complex rhythm. It is so easy to him. I remember he had orchestrated this cluster chord and he can hear every single note. And I remember he said to the pianist, he said, you know, the fourth finger of your left hand, that note, if you could play it a little bit stronger than the other nine fingers or something like that. And I said, he can hear that way. He just operates on a different wavelength, but his understanding and his desire to continue to search and to gain knowledge, he's just brilliant. He is someone that is driven by the words. He responds very much so to the text. You know, I remember when he was talking about his writings, his compositions, he said, you know, I want the listener, deliberately, I am doing this, that the listener will be uncomfortable. I don't want them to be comfortable, because we're talking about pain. We're talking about something that does not bring comfort. And I don't like when something that should really provoke and move someone is a little bit too consonant. It needs to be dissonant. There needs to be this turbulent underpinning of what we're saying. And so that's what I'm always trying to do, trying to respond to either the words or the situation when I orchestrate. So I appreciated that very much. And Terrence, you know, likewise, Terrence is someone that said, you know, I'm not done. And I hope that I offend someone. I hope that I make someone upset. I hope that I make someone angry and go back and think about this. I want to provoke thought. I want to provoke change. I want to provoke ideology, so people just can't sit there and go from day to day on the same path. I think that there is something to say, and I feel like I have the platform and the voice to say it. So working with both of them, that really inspired me to bring out my best and to try to bring the weight of the word or the sentence, the phrase that Terrence wrote, you know, coupling that with what Tyshawn did from a musical standpoint. And so Cycles of My Being, it was an exhausting experience. But it was something that I tried to put a lot of energy into to make it meaningful. And I have to say, I'm thankful that it was really positively received in all the places that we took it. So.
Growing up in a, you know, you work a lot towards and talk a lot about diversity in your field and broadly, and I guess this is maybe an assumption, but I'm wondering if that, like, you know, like, I say this because I grew up in a very diverse area, and I went to school, all my schools were just kind of very diverse, and so a push for diversity is almost kind of commonplace for me because I just want the worlds I'm in to reflect what I saw growing up and what I lived growing up. And so I'm wondering if that was also commonplace for you. I know Youngstown fairly well, and I know those areas fairly well. And did you have kind of a blueprint of diversity for you already set when you were young?
I did. My church was 99.9% African-American Black. I went to a school that was probably 85% Black, and the other 15% was probably Latino. That was my upbringing. And it wasn't until I think my second year of high school that I was really exposed to the diversity of my city. There was a show choir that I became a member of that took 12 students from the entire Youngstown area, which the West Side was usually the more Caucasian side, and the South Side was predominantly Black, and the West Side was a good mix, and the East Side where I grew up was largely African-American and Latino. So when you take all five of those schools and bring the 12 students to be a part of a musical group, and the subject or the message of that group was about unity, was about brotherhood, was about coming together. So all of my high school, I remember being amongst people that were, for the lack of a better word, different than myself, but with the idea that we were all one, we were all, you know, a family. And so I took this as really my launching pad to see the world. When I left high school, I went into college, and it was normal for me to interact with people of different races and to consider them family and to consider them someone who was equal to me. So that did really affect my viewpoint on how I see the world. I crave diversity. I crave togetherness. I crave unity. Those are the things. And I feel uncomfortable, not uncomfortable in the sense that if I go to a family reunion, everyone's Black, I feel uncomfortable. But I want to live in a community that is diverse. I want my kids, I have two kids, I want them to see diversity as the norm and feel like that they can be uniquely Black. I am very, you know, in the sense that I am very proud of my heritage, you know, because of my church, my family, my fraternity, all these other things. You know, we definitely, I have my real identity as a Black man, but I don't feel that that has to be, you know, cut off to the rest of the world. Well, I have to be a part. I feel like I can be all uniquely all those things or a part of those things, but also have a wider worldview and be a part of the global community and feel like the world is a family. So that is very much how I see the world.
The last kind of thing I want to tap into is, you know, I also travel a lot, and I know it can be hard to settle in and kind of make yourself whole while on the road. And you have a family, you know, I mostly, you know, I just have a dog, so it's a different thing. But what are your practices to kind of return to yourself, not just on the road, but when you return home, and you know, there's a big emotional curve, perhaps, from being on stage and performing, and then kind of performing the whole life with a different kind of audience as a family. So how do you return to yourself? How do you rebuild yourself and operate cleanly in those two modes?
You know, it's something that I've gotten better at, and it was hard. I have a very patient wife, and so, you know, we've had to learn how to understand this, because even though you can be away from one another, even from a marital standpoint, you can be away from one another, and the reentry into home and is not necessarily always a smooth one. And that's something that we've had to learn how to do that as well. One of the things that we live by is that we have to make the most of the time we have together count. And so it's not like it was in the past. My wife and I, we talk by FaceTime every single day, several times a day, even if there's just short kind of touching in or checking in. That's really, really important for us. A lot of times when you put on FaceTime and she puts it up in the kitchen while she's putting away groceries, or she's like doing something, she's preparing food for the kids, I'm actually passing time with her. No, we're not in the same place, but we get a sense to be able to feel like you don't have to have this phone and a still picture, phone up to your ear with a still picture, not knowing anything about this person's life. Sometimes I'll be somewhere in London and she'll say, "Oh, I like that. What is that behind you? Oh, that'd be nice in our kitchen," or something. So we can experience in a different way than people did in the past. But it's not like it, you know, being there where I can reach out my arms and she's there and I can embrace her, or, you know, I can pick my kids up. It's not the same. So I just try to take, you know, I really appreciate the time that we have together, and that I'm all hands on deck. I'm a part of dropping kids off and picking them up and going to tennis practice and picking up my son from school, or going, doing this or that, whatever it is. I get right in the trenches and go along with the, try not to disrupt the system or the routine that is home. And so when I'm on the road, it's a different reality, because I fend for myself. I do other things for myself. So anything you do for long enough, you get better at, and hopefully I'm continuing to improve and understand how to make those two differing things work as smoothly as possible.
Yeah. Are you, you know, you start out in Boston, this Sunday, and then you're kind of bouncing around a bit, it seems. Are you, building in any breaks in between there, or you kind of just go?
No, we purposely put some breaks in. I've been gone a lot, and I told my wife, just being gone more than a month really is just too much. Even that's too much. But anytime I can, I always try to put at least a few days in between. So this first time I go out, I'll be gone for about 7 days, and I come home for a whole week. Then I'll go out again for about 7 days, then I'll come home for a few days, then go out again. Then I'll be home for about 10 days before I go to New York to go to the Metropolitan Opera. So we've purposely scheduled in these breaks because definitely want to have my family close. Well, you get the chance to spend time with my family, because that is a very important part of who I am. And balancing those two, again, I'm trying to be better at, but it is something important to me that I must do it. And so, yeah, I won't just be.
Well, I hope you get some tennis in too, as as the weather warms up. I hope you get to play a little tennis
my pianist, he's a tennis player. And so he and I, we play. So we're both taking our tennis rackets, and that's definitely a part of what we do. We're like, okay, we're going to be in all these cities and see how many cities we can play tennis in. So I'll be ready for him.
Excellent. Larry, thank you so much for talking to me. And I'm excited to check out Rising. I'm going to try to get out to Philly. I think I saw a date where I could make it out. So I'm going to try to get out to Philly and see it. Because I'm just so excited about seeing it come to life. It seems like such a brilliant undertaking. So thank you for your work, and thank you for the time.
Well, I hope to meet you in person, and definitely if you can get there, let me know, because it'd be nice to just connect, okay?
For sure. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib. Join me on Tuesday, May 30th for a special live edition of my podcast, Small Joys. I'll be interviewing artist and writer Regan Buchanan. The event is free, but you need to register at wosu.org/events to reserve your seat. Support for this live show comes from the Columbus Foundation.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth. And the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys, and I have gotten into this habit now that it's a bit warmer out. I have long been in community with a group of elders who I've known for much or almost all of my adult life now. And, you know, this is at a senior center on the east side of Columbus where I'm from. And one of the things that we now do, our relationship has evolved to this point where I just kind of come over about once a month to sit with some older women and listen to some gossip, and I bring some baked goods. One of them is recently vegan, and so the baked goods are from Patty Cake Bakery, which is kind of funny to think about. A very late conversion to veganism has led to this, which is good for me because I love patty cake. And we sit and we just talk. I'm not that interested in or invested in gossip generally. Like in my normal day-to-day life, I get pretty exhausted by the notion of gossip, but in this kind of container for it, I'm kind of at home. You know, I feel very much like these elders are like elders I've known and loved my entire life, and so they're just telling me the good word of what is happening in their orbit, and I get to be a joyful audience to that, and that is just thrilling for me. And so that I got to do that last Friday, and it was really great. It's especially great because I've been traveling so much, and to get to come home and have that be a part of my routine has just been immensely, immensely joyful. And so, you know, there's all these ways that I think that travel disorients me and pulls me away from the Columbus I know and love. And so any opportunity I have to return to that Columbus I know and love is overabundant joy. So that is, it's not even a small joy at this point. It's a massive one. Honestly, I can't wait to hear the good gossip next week. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis, sound engineering by Eric French. Nick Hauser is the chief content director of digital media. Thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll be back next week with more Small Joys.